This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. We build this podcast out of a live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland called Out of Doors. So this is what we were up to this week. Hello, and I have to say the end of this week for me has been characterised by the incredibly strong wind. I mean, no sooner have the leaves come out on the trees than the wind's picked up, and our garden is just absolutely covered in a drift of stuff. Just about all the blossoms off the cherry trees, it's been blown an absolute hoolie. About 40 miles to the north of me, Mr. Ewan McElrath.
Yeah, I'm in a veritable snow shower of cherry blossom, which is lovely in one respect and saddening because it's blown it off the trees. But yeah, brilliant time of year.
We've got quite a lot coming up for you in the programme this morning. We've got our regular feature, the mystery bird. Try and identify the mystery bird this week. We're also talking to BBC Radio Scotland's environmental correspondent, Kevin Keane. His 9-year-old daughter very kindly took him out for a bike ride round about Inveroorie. I have to say, she's definitely the star of that particular piece. And we're going to try a wee bit of a sound experiment. This is Mental Health Awareness Week. I tried something this week, and it's worthwhile. Even supposing you can't go outside, supposing you just go and lie in your living room carpet, listen to this and actually see what happens. See what happens in your head, just in terms of relaxation. You've heard the piece already, Ewan. Bit of a preview. Did it work for you?
Yeah, it did work for me. It brought back the importance of just taking some time out. And you know, I'm listening just now to the wind and the trees and the birds. There is so much value to be had just by stopping for a while and drinking it in.
Yeah. Now, obviously, not everything in the countryside is your friend. Here is something by way of a timely reminder. Stunning day today. About 8:30 in the morning. And the sun's just burning through the cloud. It's warm already. Cracking visibility, too. I can see Loch na Garr to the south. Very good views of Benachie and Tappa North. And the countryside is just a patchwork of green and yellows. The yellows oilseed rape or big patches of gorse in bloom. And of course all the gorse is in bloom at the moment. Despite the fact the skylarks are singing, I'm on the hunt for a blood-sucking parasite. Interesting wee critter, it's related to scorpions and spiders, which is a point actually, because if you are in any way arachnophobic or squeamish about creepy crawlies or blood, you might want to skip the next 7 minutes of the programme. Just go and make a cup of tea or something. I've come up to the small ridge just to the east of us because this is the right kind of terrain. It's tusky grass, blaberry, there's some heather and the bracken's just beginning to show. And I have brought a white flag. I'm not going to surrender. I just want to try and catch one or two specimens. What I'm looking for is a tick. What I'm likely to find round about here is most likely a sheep tick, but there are umpteen varieties. You get hedgehog ticks, passerine ticks. Bird ticks, by the way, go in for international travel on migratory species. You get rabbit ticks, loads of bunnies round about here, red sheep ticks, and something called the ornate cow tick, which presumably only drinks the blood of decorative cows. Now, for a tick to move into your neighbourhood, it needs two things. A big enough population density of potential hosts, sheep, deer, humans. And it also needs to be damp. They like areas with moderate to high rainfall, which is why the west coast of Scotland is much, much worse for ticks than we are here in the east. Ticks have been around for a long time. Their fossilised remains have been found in beads of amber, and they're tough. About 66 million years ago, at the end of the Cretaceous period, there was a global extinction event. A huge comet or asteroid strike that wiped out just about everything on Earth bigger than a Labrador. It was truly catastrophic, but ticks just carried on drinking the blood of whatever was left standing. There are four stages in the fun-packed life of the tick. It starts off as an egg, which is pretty well microscopic. Larva, nearly microscopic. Then nymph, about the size of a poppy seed. An adult, about 3 to 5 millimetres. They live for about 3 years, and in that time, they only eat three times. Each time, the meal is incredibly simple. It's blood. Now, ticks can't jump, and they can't fly, but they can climb. The larvae come crawling out of the leaf litter and make their way up long grass stems. When they get to the top, they hang on with their hind legs and then start waving their longer front legs about, questing. They can sit there doing this for months, literally months. Why do they wave their legs about? Well, they've got this strange thing on them called a Haller's organ. It allows the tick to sense changes in temperature, air currents. Apparently, they can perceive infrared emanating from a potential host, and they can also smell us coming, our scent and the CO2 that we breathe out. At the end of each of these waving legs, they've got a little hook. And as we brush past, it hops on board, usually onto your clothing, your trouser leg, for example, which is what I've got this white flag for. It's just a piece of white cloth attached to a stick. It's nothing sophisticated. And I've never tried this before. But apparently what you do is just kind of run it across the top of the grass and see if you can con the tick into thinking that it's you. Have a shift at that. I'm not sure, that might be one there. Chances are, if a tick gets on you, you'll never notice it. It'll spend a couple hours exploring the highways and byways of your lovely form before deciding on a good place to drink your blood. There's no way you can see it with the naked eye, but it's got hooked mouth parts. And the central part is a bit like a miniature harpoon. It works this into your skin, injects enzymes that keep your blood pooling nicely, and then for the tick, it's a bit like drinking through a straw. It can spend a few days, anything up to a week, filling up with your blood and swelling up to many times its original size before it drops off. And the thing is, you may be completely unaware of this. Now, nobody likes parasites. Just the idea of them isn't terribly nice. But aside from the obvious yuck factor, they can also pass on infections or viruses, things like Lyme disease, anaplasmosis, tick-borne encephalitis. Depending on what the tick fed on last, they can pass on none of these, or maybe one of these, or if you're really unlucky, a couple at once. If you get the double option, it can make diagnosis a nightmare as you, in the words of Bill Bryson, erupt into a positive fiesta of symptoms. Now, I really don't want to overplay this. Even if you do find a tick on you, the chances are you're going to lose a little blood, and that is it. But if you have been bitten by a tick and you get an odd rash, a ring of redness with a clear area in the middle, it's called a bullseye rash, go and see your doctor. Get it checked out. What if you do find a tick on your person? How do you get rid of it? Well, folk used to say daft stuff like, oh, smother it in Vaseline or baby oil or nail polish, none of which is a good idea. Some folks say you should use tweezers. Grasp the feeding tick as close to the skin as you can and just pull it out. Now, I used to think tweezers were a good idea until I read an article by an academic called Professor Cheryl Van Nooyen, who wrote, and to be honest, this is seared into my brain now, that tweezers are tick squeezers. Think about it. This thing is drinking your blood through a straw, and it's like a little balloon. Grab it the wrong way, and it's going to be a bit like squeezing a toothpaste tube or a ketchup bottle. Some of that blood, admittedly, probably yours, but goodness knows what else from inside the tick will get injected back into you, which is probably not the best outcome. Ideally, you should lay your hands on a tick spoon or a card, or there's a wee plastic thing like a tiny crowbar, all of which allows you to evict the tick without squeezing it or leaving any part of it behind, still stuck in you. As I say, the object of the exercise here is not to worry you. I've spent most of my life outdoors and I have never, ever found a tick on me. Now, that doesn't mean I haven't had a tick on me, just that I didn't notice it. They've been doing this for about 100 million years. They've had time to refine their act. They're good at it.
Ah, that's the way to start the morning, talking about a blood-sucking parasite. Have you ever had one on you?
No, not that I'm aware of. But it's possibly because you don't have a close enough friend that's prepared to rake around the intimate parts of your body after a walk in the hills.
Yeah, it's entirely possible. Entirely possible.
But you can imagine all those... Go on.
No, I was going to say, do you remember we went out Mount Keene years ago with Arthur Anderson and some of his chums? And there was those two ladies, and they were talking about... Well, one lady said she'd got a tick right between, you know, basically in her cleavage. And her husband spotted it in the bath and got a terrible fright.
Yes, because he... anyway, let's gloss over that. That was an interesting walk that day.
Yeah, it was a very interesting walk. I mean, if you've got, you know, a tick story, you know, whether it's salutary or otherwise, let us know. You can give us a call and, you know, text us on 80295, or you can call us on 08085 92 95 00. Any advice?
But you can just imagine. Yeah, just imagine people. I was thinking there. You know, we've started programs for many years now with very different topics, but I think there can't be any that you've started with people sitting over their Wheaties bangs going, "Oh no." What a way to start a programme.
I bet you will.
I'm sure we can beat it. But people must have lots of tick stories. I took one off Bracken, my dog, yesterday, a wee tiny one, and they're just rife at the moment.
Yeah.
She'll come back with about 4 or 5 regularly.
Yeah, there seems to be quite a lot on social media about it at the moment, which is why I thought it was worth talking about it generally. One thing we've learned during this lockdown period is that the folk that tune into this, people like yourself, I'm mad keen on birds. You've been telling us about the birds you've been hearing and seeing and very kindly sending us in clips of their calls.
Yeah, I'm just looking out in the garden at the moment. There's a dunnock. There's the wagtail I was talking about earlier. There's actually the mystery bird that we're going to talk about, if I can try and not give it away before too long, because Craig McInnes got in touch and he very kindly went out and did very good recording of a bird. He was in the Burnley House, appropriately, Burn Valley Park, known locally as the Dip. And he says he'd never seen or heard this little bird before. Here's a clip.
Well, Craig, I can tell you that that is a chaffinch, but don't take my word for it. We've checked with a friend of the show, Kirsty Nutt of the RSPB, and she says it's definitely a chaffinch.
Yeah, and we thought it was too easy, and then we thought we'd have the mystery bird, and frankly, I think this one's even easier. If you know what this bird is, get in touch and tell us what this very, very distinctive bird is. Have a wee listen to this. Okay, if you know what that is, and... frankly, most of you must, because we had the woodpecker last week and we were inundated with phone calls. You know, there's no prizes for this, just the honour of getting it right. And, yeah, well, you can email if you do know what that is, and we'll give you some clues throughout the programme. I was going to give you one, but Mark said it was too easy.
Yep.
outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, text 80295, tweet @bbcoutofdoors, and Sam's there to take your calls. He's on 08085 92 95 00. And if you've got a story that goes with it, because it is a bird that really people love it.
Yep.
And there's a lot of stories to go with it, so we'll share that with you over the next wee while.
I do have a clue which I think is slightly more obtuse, which is namely that it was quite a popular brand of wine back in the sort of late 70s early 80s.
Oh, Blue Nun.
Yes, that twittering noise is a Blue Nun. We've been doing these midweek podcasts. It's a new thing we've been doing on the Scotland Outdoors podcast. And we've been having enormous fun with it. Basically, we felt that during lockdown there was a desire for more content relating to the natural world. Now, we've spoken to some fascinating people who've been sharing their stories and sounds of nature, and this week's, I think, was an absolute cracker. Chris Watson is an award-winning professional sound recorder who's worked with David Attenborough. He's spent a career gathering sound from across the globe. So when we asked Chris to curate a series of his favourite sounds from across an entire career, he very kindly did.
This is a pod of orcas, killer whales, in the Ross Sea in Antarctica. I was down there for a television series called Frozen Planet 10 years ago, actually, and we went out onto the surface of a frozen ocean. I mean, it sounds bizarre. We've flown out there in a helicopter about 20 kilometres offshore, and these great cracks appear in the sea ice, which are called leads. And when they appear, the orcas swim up these cracks because they're hunting seals and penguins, and they're air-breathing mammals like us, so they need to be able to surface and take a breath. So they all come up these cracks, and they're hunting, and they're using their echolocation, and they're making contact calls. And so I put my hydrophones into these cracks in the sea ice. Hydrophones are underwater microphones. And I made this recording as 20 or 30 orca pass by my hydrophones. The interesting thing is, of course, is it's known down there, people think of the poles as quiet, silent places, and they are very quiet when the wind's not blowing on the surface, but all the action is under the sea ice, and everything under the sea ice lives in a world of sound and vibration. So it's full of sound, it's a very sound-rich place.
Scary though, wasn't it? Because they're so intelligent. I remember seeing the clip when the orca comes up, has a look at the seals, and then they all seem to have a chat, and they come back and have a right old go.
Yeah, I was there when that was filmed, actually. It's remarkable. I mean, I'm not trying to be anthropomorphic, but I think orca are the most intelligent animals on this planet, and that includes humans. Their brains are several times larger than ours. They are air-breathing mammals, as I said, like we are. So we evolved in the oceans along with orcas. We came out onto the land, as did orcas, and became air-breathing mammals. And then at some point, we stayed on the land. We made the decision to stay on the land, and orcas went back into the ocean. This planet, it's not planet Earth, is it? It's planet ocean, because 70% of this planet is occupied by the seas and the oceans. And we live on the little dry bits in between. So we stay up here, paying 20% VAT, and orcas have free range of the entire planet. And they live in these wonderful extended family groups called pods. They range wherever they like. They're the apex predator in the oceans. Nothing bothers orcas. So they've developed this. Some say they've developed a language and a culture because they communicate at great speeds and they use echolocation. They see with sound, a bit like bats. So they're remarkable animals, highly evolved. And, it must be nice to be able to swim around the oceans untroubled. The only problem they've got, of course, is the noise pollution that we put into the seas and oceans.
photographer Herbert Ponting, who went with Scott down to the Antarctic, ended up in one situation where he had his tripod set up on a floe and the orcas were coming up and trying to tip up the edge of the floe so that he would slide off the other end. And because, as far as I'm concerned, you know, human seal, what difference? Actually, at any stage, when you were that close to them, did you feel under threat?
The strangest situation is when they come out of the water. They have this technique when they're looking for seals on the ice called spy hopping. These 7 metre long, 5 tonne orcas will come vertically out of the water and just hang there and halfway out of the water and scan the ice for potential prey. And if you're standing on the edge with a hydrophone or a camera, they look at you, and they look at you directly, and that's one of the... I suppose it is scary, but it's you just freeze, because these animals actually raise themselves above you and look down at you and scan you, obviously sizing you up in terms of their menu, and then just sink back into the oceans. There's no history of orca predating humans, people. I think they're too smart. They realise we're just... sort of skin and bone. We're not really like a juicy seal. But when they take a good look at you with their eye, then it's that such close contact with an animal of such intelligence that's quite a stimulating experience. The worst part, one of those, was I was in a similar position a week or so later by an ice hole in the Ross Sea, and a minke whale surfaced to breathe. And just exhaled all over me, so I was covered in whale snot, which was worse, really, than being scanned by an orca.
The sound of orcas in the Ross Sea in Antarctica, as recorded by the wonderful Chris Watson. Now, we've been doing this programme a long time, Ewan, have we not? I have to say, and this is no reflection on us at all, it's purely in terms of the quality of his recordings and his stories. I think that's one of the best things we've ever been involved with.
Well, I'm actually coming to the stage of saying this on a weekly basis. I really cannot recommend highly enough going to the Scotland Outdoors podcast, because there have been some fantastic people we've been speaking to. And I honestly, you could sit at the knee of Chris and listen to it forever. And coming up next week, I was asking him a question about one specific piece of wildlife that I've been trying to record for many years, and he told me how to do it, and it is just... Yeah. Incredible. Now, yesterday, Scotland's charity Air Ambulance celebrated its 7th birthday. And on average, they respond to one call out every day. Now, both Mark and I have recorded crews in the past, and you'll hear a little bit of my hair-raising experience in a moment. But first of all, for more about the SCAA, we're joined by the Chief Executive, David Craig. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
Happy 7th birthday to the charity, David. How did it actually begin?
Well, it began quite some time before then, probably about maybe 5 years before that, what the kind of the concept and idea was developed from a kind of group of local Perthshire business people, and looking at the position in Scotland with emergency air ambulance transfer. And obviously that took some time to, you know, get the various approvals through the various public bodies, working with, you know, the Scottish Ambulance Service and the Scottish Government. And as you say, we launched just 7 years ago yesterday from Perth Airport, and we've been responding since then to around about 2,500 emergency call-outs throughout all of Scotland, but particularly in remote and rural locations where it's very difficult to have land transfer or very quick ambulance transfer, and obviously an air ambulance brings that rapid paramedic care to the scene and transfer to the most appropriate hospital.
David, how does it work? Because you've got full-time air ambulances. I mean, do you just fly the backup to that? What's the mechanism for that?
Well, we are fully integrated into the Scottish Ambulance Service, so we would be deployed in exactly the same way as any other air ambulance asset in Scotland. It's a very, very strong third-sector, public-sector partnership. And it's also what we have in Scotland is a very, very unique situation, which is totally different to the rest of the UK, where we have that blend of statutory government-funded aircraft through Scotland's charity ambulance, we're funded by the people of Scotland, so we don't receive government funding or any regular statutory funding. Everything that we do is 100% funded by the people of Scotland. And in the last 7 years, they have contributed and raised over £30 million to keep us flying, which is just an enormous achievement. And, you know, we're always very humbled by what people are doing for us.
Yeah, no, it's an incredible thing, David. And Mark and I have both done stuff with you. But back in 2013, I got a chance to experience what it's like to be a casualty, being rescued by the air ambulance. An incredible experience as you're here with paramedic Alexander Holden and the rest of the crew.
So now what we'll do is we'll lift you up on this board, put you on a vacuum mattress, take the board away, then the vacuum mattress...
We are going to treat you as possible multi-injury, so we'll have a stiff neck collar on and we'll keep you fully immobilised for further investigation at the hospital.
It sounds like quite a frightening prospect.
No, it shouldn't be. We'll give you plenty of reassurance.
Because that's not a very big hole, is it?
No, it's not at all, no. It's all right when you come at the other end. Initially, when you're getting loaded in through the back, quite daunting. But, yeah, you'll be made at ease.
Right. All right, just keep your hands on your stomach for us.
Okay.
That's it. Right, everyone happy?
Yep. Good.
Everyone get a corner?
Static.
Yeah. Right, you're going into the tunnel now, Ewan.
Excellent.
Just shut your eyes when you go in, all right? And you'll be met by a paramedic at the other end. Alright.
Okay. Why do you shut your eyes?
Do you want to
it's quite tight.
Right.
So it's easier to shut your eyes.
Alright,
okay.
Come and take over.
How was that?
That's quite terrifying, actually.
Yeah. Imagine, obviously, if you're feeling pretty unwell and
yeah,
you know you're having to get slid in, it could be a bit scary for you, so...
Well, you shut your eyes, you
would. Lovely. Okay, alright. Get it off.
You alright? Yeah. Take a breather.
Okay.
It's cosy, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it is what it is. It's a helicopter.
Yeah.
And, you know, it serves a purpose. This helicopter's done that purpose for several years, so...
You okay in there, sir?
Yeah, as good as it gets.
Good.
Yeah. I say, once we're up in the air, we'll get you sitting up a little bit.
Okay, you all ready?
Yeah,
good.
Fuel's coming in, temperature's rising, blades are turning. That's first peak, 750 degrees.
Quite disorientating.
Yes, it is very. Yeah.
So, have you done the strapped in bit?
This bit?
Yeah.
But yeah, no.
No. Highly recommend it.
Yeah. Okay, obviously, that's us down, eh?
Yeah.
Once we shut down, we'll get you out there to have to get you back on your feet. Okay?
It's fine after the initial panic.
Yeah.
You know, it makes perfect sense to take the one claustrophobe on the team and shove him through a tiny hole into the back of a helicopter.
I don't know if you would have fitted in it.
No, probably not. Probably not. David,
but
you... Sorry, carry on.
I was just going to say, we've done some challenging things in your time, but actually holding a tape recorder and a microphone while you're strapped into a stretcher and in the back of a helicopter was quite a challenge, but you know, fantastic experience.
Good on you for doing it. David, you unveiled a second helicopter based in Aberdeen just at the start of April. What are the sort of economic implications for that in terms of raising money?
Well, yeah, it was a very challenging time to launch it. We were, you know, developing a base. It wasn't just about launching a helicopter. You develop everything that goes along with it. And, you know, that presented challenge when we went into lockdown. But, you know, through the strong partnership we have, working with the Scottish Ambulance Service and our aviation partners, Babcock, we all pulled together to launch that at the beginning of April. Yeah, you know, like many charities and lots of other businesses, you know, we will have a significant fundraising impact. A lot of our stuff that we do, particularly we're coming into this summer season, was a lot of community and fundraising events. And, of course, there's that whole degree of uncertainty as to when that could possibly return to any kind of normality. So yeah, there will be a significant fundraising impact for ourselves. And we received some very welcome news yesterday through the Department of Health and Social Care as an emergency relief to Air Ambulance UK, which was £6 million, but that was spread across the whole of the United Kingdom. You know, we haven't got sight of that money yet. I don't quite know when that's likely to come, but it's likely to be a couple hundred thousand pounds. Oh. That's an encouraging start, but we will still need the support of people of Scotland, and they are remarkable. They keep supporting us. over the last 7 years, and I have no doubt that they will continue to do so through these very challenging times.
I think people really know how valuable your service is, and best of luck for the next 7 years, David. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
We were talking earlier about the Scotland Outdoors podcast midweek, and Chris Watson, Drew and Shona McIntyre on Facebook said, thank you, Chris, for sharing these amazing soundscapes. I find that listening to nature through good headphones can be even more immersive than watching it on TV. They were all amazing, but the bearded seal was otherworldly. Brilliant broadcasting. Really, seriously, have a shifty to that. Because, I mean, the bearded seal does sound as if it's actually been put together, I don't know, on a synthesizer, Ewan.
Yeah, it's an amazing sound, but what Chris does, I remember those images vividly, but you know, images without sound are nothing, and the man is a genius. I'd really highly recommend going listening to it. It's fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. Stay with us, because coming up, I take a moment to look up. We talk about the splendour of the squirrels and, of course, our mystery bird of the week.
So if you know what that is, and let's face it, you probably do, then get in touch. Sam's there to take your calls. He's on 08 085 92 95 00. You can get in touch via Facebook, or you can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk or text 80295. I don't know if it's time to start giving clues for that yet.
Yeah, you could give a wee one.
What, like it takes more than one to make a summer?
I think you've just blown that wide open, to be honest. I would say,
well,
so
I'm watching three of them screaming around me at the moment. Yeah. They're just such delightful birds to watch.
Yeah, no, they're great things. I've actually mentioned this hill already in this programme, but part of the sort of vista I can take in towards the west of me is obviously Benachie and Tapa North. University of Aberdeen archaeologists recently uncovered evidence that the Tapa North near Huntly in Aberdeenshire was one of the largest ancient settlements ever discovered in Scotland. Professor Gordon Noble led the research, and Gordon joins us now to tell us more. Good morning, Gordon. How are you doing?
Morning. Yep, fine. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Very well. Listen, describe Tapa North as it is now. Is there anything to see above ground?
Oh, yeah. It's a really impressive hill fort. So on the top, you've got a vitrified fort, which is really obvious. It used to be in the 18th century thought to be an ancient volcano, but it's actually a vitrified fort. But the fort we've been working on is actually lower down. It's a bit harder to see, and that's where things like aerial photography and drone imaging has helped us reveal this huge enclosure that's down the lower slopes of the hill, which is about 17 hectares, so that's something like 30 football pitches in extent. So it's Scotland's second biggest hill fort. And inside, wow, there's up to 800 house platforms, so a huge, huge settlement.
Have you put that in some kind of context? Because you guys have known about this site for some time. I mean, how big a discovery was that?
Well, we've been working in the valley for years now, since 2011, working down by the village where we found a high-status Pictish settlement dating from the 4th to the 6th centuries AD, and that's where stones like the Rhynie Man and the Crossdane come from. And in recent years, we've been working on Tapa North, really to try and put that site in its context. So the fort on top is much older. It dates to 400 to 200 BC. And it was always assumed the lower fort was older than that, perhaps even Bronze Age in date. But we dug part of the rampart and two house platforms last summer. And very surprisingly, I must admit, I was quite gobsmacked by this. We got the dates back about a month ago, and so the lower fort seems to be contemporary with what we've got down in the valley, so dating from the 4th to the 6th centuries AD again. And we only dug two of the platforms, so we think there's about 800, but we got dates of the same period again, so it looks like potentially we have this huge late Roman Iron Age Pictish period settlement, which is just really, you know, we have nothing else like that in Scotland or indeed Britain, Ireland of that extent. So it's, you know, 2-3 times the size of any contemporary settlement that we know of.
It's extraordinary that you found this settlement. Take me right back up to the top through the vitrified fort. What is a vitrified fort? How do you vitrify a fort?
Well, that's one of the questions that archaeologists have been trying to answer for centuries, really. So essentially, it was a fort built with stone and a timber framework, and at some point that has been set on fire, and the fire has been so hot that it's essentially melted the rock. So they're a really distinctive type of hill fort. You find a lot of them in Scotland. And so it's always been a bit of a mystery as to how you actually melt the rock and get that heat, really. And it's probably because, you know, examples like Tappenoth are so high up. This is, you know, Scotland's second highest hill fort. So, you know, you get a fair wind up there. So if it has gone on fire, probably deliberately, you know, looks like, you know, these fires are actually deliberately set. And that creates that vitrification process. And it's, you know, got to be one of the best examples in Scotland of that.
Well, it's a perfect day today for vitrifying a fort. It's absolutely screaming at the moment. But would that have been a defensive place to be, or would they live there full time? Because, you know, 4,000 people, it's kind of mind blowing. It's more than live in that area at the moment.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, it's huge. I mean, we don't know if that number's true. We've only dug 2 out of 800, but you know, there's no real evidence for any of the platforms overlapping or intercutting. And, you know, why build a new platform when you can just reoccupy older ones? So it's a good bet that a lot of these are actually contemporary, but obviously we need to do more work and get a bigger sample. But it could also be that this is, you know, a seasonal assembly site where people are gathering certain times of year at an important landscape that's quite a connected landscape. So loads of questions really to address now, but it's really exciting we've got these results and we can actually do a bit more work to try and piece the story together.
How big a leap forward do you think this is, Gordon, in terms of what we know about Aberdeenshire at that period?
Well, it's a leap forward in terms of what we know about, you know, early Britain and Ireland in this time period. You know, we have so few sites, particularly in Scotland, in the Pictish period. And, you know, you were talking about a couple of dozen sites we know from that time period. You know, compare that to the Iron Age, the time of the vitrified fort, where we know hundreds, if not thousands, of sites. So just finding sites from that time period is quite difficult. And then finding something on the scale is just really something we hadn't thought about existing on that scale until, you know, you get the early times of the 12th century. So, no, it's really, really exciting and looking forward to doing more work there.
I'm looking forward to the time when I actually go and take a look at it myself. Gordon, thank you very much for joining us again.
No worries, thank you.
Professor Gordon Noble there from Aberdeen University. It's been years since I've been up Tappenoth. I mean, literally years.
Well, it's kind of poor relation to Benahee, isn't it?
Yes, I would imagine so. It's Mental Health Awareness Week, so we thought we'd take a few minutes just to reflect on how spending time in the outdoors can be therapeutic for all of us, but especially for folk who find themselves regularly suffering from mental ill health.
Yeah, there's kind of obvious benefits, which I'm sure many of us have noticed during lockdown, of just slowing it down, taking notice of the natural world around you. But it can go much further than that.
Yeah, I actually met this gentleman, if memory serves me right, I think it was just on the beach at Oban. Nick Ray is a sea kayaker, and Nick suffers regularly from severe depression. He spent a career working in the outdoors for organisations like Outward Bound, but when he was first diagnosed in 1995, he had to put his professional knowledge to the test. He explained to Helen Needham from his home in Mull what it is about being in the outdoors, being active in the outdoors, that he finds so helpful.
I just love the simplicity of life in the outdoors, how I immediately feel very grounded when I go outdoors. I feel very much at home in the outdoor realm. So it's very helpful for me from that point of view. I started working for Outward Bound when I was living in Wales, and I've been lucky enough to work for Outward Bound in Africa. And yeah, I've been involved with psychotherapy in the outdoors, wilderness therapy and personal development work in the outdoors. A huge range of experiences working with people in the outdoors. So I have a deep understanding of how the outdoor effect can really enhance our lives. And I think that's what really informs me about how I view my own life in the outdoors and how I view my life living with depression and how it helps with my recovery when being outdoors.
So with your informed knowledge about the therapeutic benefits of the outdoors, then how do you specifically apply this to your own mental ill health?
I think it's just making it simple, making it a simple process, not trying to complicate matters, really. Being outdoors enables me to slow the pace of life down, you know, adopt the pace of nature. I mean, there's huge metaphors to be drawn from my experiences in the outdoors, help me understand some of the processes that I may be facing. Also, just the simplicity of just enjoyment, really. I mean, it's an environment which I feel incredibly comfortable within. So there's a huge amount of pleasure to be gained from that. And I think it's good for us to do things that are pleasurable. I think too often we give ourselves a hard time. We feel we ought to be stepping up to the mark and doing things that are worthwhile. But simply being outdoors and taking time for ourselves, I think that's hugely important as well.
You have done some quite major challenges on your kayak. So you've really pushed yourselves physically and mentally in certain situations.
I think, again, my relationship with the outdoors or the outdoor realm is one of challenge as well. I never set out to compete with the outdoors. I never use that language. Well, I hope I never use that language where I want to compete with the sea or fight the tides. But I do feel challenged, and I think that's a personal challenge. You know, it's overcoming personal fear. With regard to my mental health recovery, I mean, there's one particular memory. I was doing the Three Peaks by kayak, which involved paddling down from Fort William down to Mid Wales and climbing Ben Nevis, Scafell Pike and Snowdon along the way. And I paddled around the Mulla Galloway in the early hours of the morning and was faced with crossing Luce Bay, which was a 17-mile open water crossing from the Mulla Galloway across to the Isle of Whittle. And by the time I reached that stretch of water, the tide was against me and the sun was up and high and it was a boiling hot day. And I found myself in the middle of Luce Bay, literally being swept backwards by the tide. You know, if I stopped paddling, then my kayak would move backwards. And, you know, I felt incredibly dispirited and thought I was never going to get anywhere. I was, you know, they still had another 10 miles to get across to the Isle of Whittle. And I'd run out of water and I was feeling very uncomfortable. And I considered then just giving up, just sort of allowing the tide to take me back to the Mulla Galloway. When it occurred to me that tides change and, you know, the situation would reverse, you know, that the tide would then flow in my favour. And it was summertime and I still had plenty of hours of daylight left. So if I could sit with the discomfort, then in a few hours' time I would continue and I'd get across just as easily as I would have done, you know, if the tide had been with me. And that's what I did. And as a metaphor, it's really powerful because when I'm in the midst of my depression, when I'm feeling incredibly discomforted by the illness, I can draw on that awareness knowing that this will pass, this situation will pass, that it will not last forever. That even though it may feel like it's going to last forever, it won't last forever. And as long as I can reconnect with that by drawing on these memories, you know, there's many others as well, then that's incredibly helpful.
And that's really pertinent to the situation that we all find ourselves living in just now with lockdown, actually, reminding ourselves that actually this isn't, it's not forever as well, so the waves will pass.
Yes, yes. And again, it's being able to manage our own discomfort and being patient. I think that's the challenge. So when we talk about challenge in the outdoors, sometimes it's that, it's managing our human discomfort. It's not challenging ourselves against nature. It's within ourselves. And I think when we overcome that, there's huge amounts of learning to be gained from that and very, very powerful.
Not everyone, though, would want to put themselves in a situation like that on the open waters. What would you suggest then if somebody is feeling that sense of discomfort within their mental health, how they might be able to, in a simple way, use nature and the outdoors to help them?
I think it's to find their own path and to begin to do what they're comfortable with. And I don't think you need to set yourself great challenges, as you suggest. I mean, I think maybe that would be counterproductive because maybe then people would be so worried about coming through safely or whether they'd be able to make it that they've missed the learning to be gained. Maybe doing a different walk, for example, or, you know, looking at the map and being inquisitive about what may lie within the contours that they're looking at or on, along a certain path, and just taking themselves into a place that may be new to them or slightly unusual. and just being aware of what's occurring. And I think it's not just being aware of the bird song or the sound of the river or the sound of the wind through the trees. It's being aware of our own responses. You know, how do I feel right now? And, you know, what am I thinking of right now? And at the end of it, what did I gain from this? I mean, there's so many different approaches. Unfortunately, with lockdown, it's difficult to do these kind of things with other people, but sometimes it's useful to do it with a friend where you can walk in companionable silence, maybe, or just walk and talk softly with each other. And through somebody else's awareness, you might gain some insights yourself. So I certainly think that my approach may be seen as quite extreme, but then I suppose that's the level I'm at with my outdoor experience. And, you know, I'm comfortable with that. But for many people, obviously, just going for a walk is just what's needed, really.
Nick Ray there. And if you'd like to find out more about Nick, he's got quite a following on Twitter. I follow him on Twitter. You'll find him at Life Afloat. And you can also read his blogs, which are remarkable, at lifeafloat.co.uk. Interesting guy, Ewan.
Fascinating. I really can't imagine what that's like with 19 miles or whatever it was of open water going against the tide and not having any drinking water with you. It's just such an incredible challenge. Yeah. But he was talking about, I don't want to talk about fighting the sea or battling the sea. And I kind of agree with every time I've battled with the sea's won.
Yeah. I think it's that old thing about the fact, you know, it's we're not competing against nature, because frankly nature most of the time is aware of the fact we're there. But one of the advantages of going out there and sort of opening your mind is you become aware of the fact you are part of it. You know, and you're not separate to it. And the more you can connect with that, I think the better it is for your mental health generally. Here's something that I thought we'd give a go. This is by way, really, of a sound experiment of our own. We spoke last week about something which we're just going to come on to again. But have a listen to these sounds. Just wherever you are, doesn't matter if you're in the kitchen, go through the living room, lie down, whatever. But have a listen to these sounds and see what you think. See if this works for you.
I'm going to try something new here. My head is absolutely mince today. I've got about half a dozen jobs I need to do, and I can't make up my mind which takes priority, and consequently I'm doing none of them, and consequently that's frustrating me, and I'm just getting a bit knocked with the whole thing. So I've decided to try some Shinrin Yoku. Some forest bathing, what we covered last week in the programme, with Caitlin Keddy. But in the corner of my garden. See if it works. And the idea is to immerse yourself in nature. So, I'm lying on my back on the lawn, feet pointing roughly north. So the sun's to the south, not that there's much sun, because it's cloudy today. And I've got a baseball cap on, so that the light's not too bright, because even on a cloudy day, it's surprising. You find yourself squinting up at the sky. Forest bathing was kind of pioneered in Japan, so this is quite appropriate. Underneath a wild cherry tree in bloom at the moment. It's kind of shivering in the breeze. You can see the serrated leaves and the petals and the stems of the blossoms up against the sort of dove grey sky. Blue sky off to my right there, but it's closing up. Bizarrely, the cloud seems to be moving in two directions. Cloud's always worth a look-see, has to be said. It's got distinct edges. And if you look at it closely, you can see the vapour being sucked from underneath the cloud off round the edge kind of forms tendrils, but like water or a rock. What I thought was an insect there in amongst the blossom, it's actually a common buzzard, but it's seriously high. I don't know, several hundred, maybe 1,000 feet up. And it's just riding the thermals today. Circling round and round. Every time it completes a lap, it gets higher. The sun's just broken through, so I can feel it warm on my upper body. And the grass itself underneath me is quite cool. Very distinctive smell, grass. Particularly freshly cut grass. That's one of the six jobs I can't make up my mind about. Caitlin was telling us to pay attention to our senses, you know, to think about what our bodies were doing in relation to the ground. And the biggest surprise lying down here was the fact that the grass was warm. It rained last night, and I would have thought it was going to be a bit damp, but no. Buzzard's got a pal now. This isn't so much about emptying your brain as just letting other stuff in. Better stuff. You can hear sparrows. Some chaffinches. There's a male blackbird singing up in one of his song pots at the top of the garden. I can hear the hum of bees in the blossom above me. Every so often there's a sort of whir of bird wings going past. I should have done this earlier. It definitely works. I'm not feeling stressed in the slightest now. And I've come to a decision. Reviewing the half dozen jobs that are in prospect, I'm not going to do any of them. I'm just going to lie here for a while. The next sound you hear is probably going to be me snoring. Or that bee.
Lovely piece of music, that. I honestly don't know. As I said, that's more by the way of an experiment, more than anything else. It certainly worked for me. I'd be interested to find out if it worked for you at the same time. You ever done anything like that, Ewan?
Oh, I do it all the time. The trouble is, somebody will come out and say, what are you doing? Why are you not doing the jobs that you've listed? But if we're just doing that, I every time I lie down on my back and start drinking the sounds of nature, the sound of the wind, the leaves, the bees and the birds, I just get this image of Claire Grogan in Gregory's Girl lying underneath the tree and kicking out. It is such a great thing to do. Yeah. And at night as well, it's a great thing to do. Yeah. Proper stargazing, but... Yeah. It's so much as we experienced during that forest bathing thing, you become so much aware of sounds, and sometimes it's not always pleasant. You know, the helicopter in the distance becomes an irritant, the motorbike, or the guy with the dump valve on his Ford Fiesta. You know, it's, I want to listen to the trees.
Yeah, quite. Let me get through some comments. I mean, Anne Young says, good morning, I live in Oban. I think the mystery bird this week is a goldfinch. They're regular visitors to my bird feeder. They're beautiful birds, Anne, but it's the wrong answer. Colin and Mary Abercrombie and Dunblane says, house sparrow. Following on from the great spotted woodpecker last week, we watched an adult male disappearing through a perfectly round hole to feed the noisy chicks inside. Simply wonderful. Hugh and Angus, this is less poetic, says, I seem to be a tick magnet on walks. Get them frequently. Got one on my leg this week. Once got one on my, well, a very sensitive place. Now regularly check myself carefully all over. Barry in Ballater says, fit like the day, enjoying the show as usual. The air ambulance doing a fantastic job, a great asset, especially for rural areas, and a chance to highlight the great work all NHS workers and other healthcare and key workers do. I'll be raising a dram to them later on tonight. Barry the Butcher for Ballater. And one last point here from Roger. Good morning, gents. Blowing a gale here in King's Kettle and Fife this morning with the odd squally shower flung into the mix. The dews and the sparrows are fechting the wind to try and yoke onto the bird table, grafting hard for their breakfast this morning. I know the feeling. You're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElraith. If you miss any of this, there are a few ways of listening again.
There's loads of ways. You can catch up whenever you want by looking the programme up on the BBC Sounds app.
Or you can download the Free Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available from BBC Sounds. As I said to you earlier, we've got this new midweek slot talking to people who've got a special affinity with nature. Thoroughly recommend it this last week. Chris Watson, we've had Frank Gardner, Alison Balance from New Zealand. We're talking to some very interesting people on that. We do like hearing where you listen. We'd also like to hear your suggestions for people we could talk to. You can email us your stories at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, which is what Christine Carter does. Carter did. She says, hi there, I've been listening to Scotland Outdoors podcast for years. I started when we were living near Barcelona and my eldest child moved to Scotland. We're now waiting out COVID in the Netherlands.
And she goes on to say, it's never failed to be interesting, charming, soothing and delightful. And I just read on Facebook that you're extending it to speak to naturalists from around the world. And I just wanted to thank you for all the work you're doing. The podcast is a relief and a delight. And I'm always happy to see it appearing in my feed.
Your BBC Radio Scotland Young Traditional Musician of the Year 2020 is Ali Levac.
It's the perfect launchpad for the next generation of Scotland's greatest folk musicians.
It feels like a bit of a dream, to be honest.
Could you or someone you know be next year's winner?
If you're a singer or instrumentalist aged between 16 and 27 on June the 25th, this could be the opportunity you've been waiting for.
You've got until midnight on June the 25th to apply. To enter, BBC Radio Scotland's Young Traditional Musician of the Year 2021. And for full terms and privacy notice, head to bbc.co.uk/youngtrad.
There have been some fabulous musicians that have come out of that competition. So seriously, if you know anybody or you are that person, why not? Just give it a go, see what actually happens. Lockdown.
We should enter the old
old traditional musician. Finger in the right ear. Yeah.
Yeah.
Lockdown. You could do, what's the one you always do? The Chuchter for Sky.
Aye.
Heedrum
the poetry kid.
Oh, Heedrum. All together now.
Dubbed the word a heed with a curling stain.
Lockdown has impacted on us all in different ways over the past few weeks. There have been a lot of negatives, but some positives as well. Wildlife photographer Karen Miller is no different. She's found being stuck at home in the Highlands has had some positives, especially in terms of her photography. Karen, you used to work for the Beeb. You relocated from Glasgow at the end of last year to near Inverness. Good move?
Yes. Oh, I no regrets whatsoever. And I think with what's happened recently, you know, being where I am now in a rural community as opposed to in a house in the city centre is so much better. I feel incredibly lucky right now.
So what have you been spotting in the garden?
Well, in the garden I have hundreds of birds. I mean, incredible number of birds, all the regular ones you'd expect to see, the various finches. I've also got tree sparrows and house sparrows. I've got a pheasant that my dog was just barking at. He comes in regularly. I've got rabbits come along and eat my slightly too long lawn. And there's badgers overnight. I had a pine marten on my trail camera in the garden as well a few nights ago. So it's wonderful. It looks just every day I get up and you just don't know what you're going to see out the window. It's incredible.
I know that the squirrels are something of a particular favourite of yours.
Yeah, when I moved, I started putting trail cams up in the wood behind my house. I have a little path into a section of wood, and nobody goes there because there isn't really any public access to that specific bit of it. And I started putting trail cameras up, and I got quite addicted to trail cameras. It's seeing the
it's
hidden
it's a bad
world
habit.
That you just don't know
you
there.
You think you can handle it, and then it gets away from you.
Yeah, and so I put up the camera, and the first thing that came up was a pine marten and a badger, and that was hugely exciting. But of course, they're mostly nocturnal. And then suddenly there was a red squirrel on the feeder, and I had no idea there were red squirrels in that section of wood because it's deciduous, and you always think of red squirrels mostly in pine wood. Mm-hmm. So I found a nice spot that's quite private, and I put up a squirrel feeder, and now I've got 5 squirrels visiting, and I've got a little pop-up hide. And I basically, it's almost like going to work in the morning. I get up, and I have my breakfast, walk the dog, and then I go and sit with the squirrels for 2 or 3 hours, and it's the first time I've ever spent that much time with one specific group of animals. And, you know, normally when I photograph red squirrels, it would be at a paid hide, and you'd have 4 hours, and you were there to take photographs. But actually having my own red squirrels, you begin to recognise them by their personalities, and you start learning about all their different behaviours. And it's been fascinating and really, really educational.
But they take quite a while to learn how to work the feeders. Well, I've actually got a bit of red squirrel war going on with my neighbours because they've got red squirrels. I've been trying to poach them off by putting feeders up and it's working to a certain extent. But watching, I mean, just describe A, the feeder, and B, the method they use to get into it, because it takes them a while to learn.
Yeah, it's a box with a lid. I could tell that these squirrels had never been to a garden squirrel feeder before when I put the box up, because again, I have a trail camera on it all the time. And it was quite funny watching them initially, but they figured it out. It almost looked like they were scratching their heads, because they'd come up and they'd sort of use their head to try and lift the lid. They'd use their mouth to try and lift the lid, and then it would keep falling down on them. I think it's a youngster that's just appeared in the last couple of weeks, and I'm calling Wee Bruce. And the camera footage of him has been hilarious, because he's been absolutely determined to get in the box. And he takes quite a while, and he falls off, and he bangs his head. But he always does it. He makes it. But watching it had me crying with laughter. But they're just, the thing about red squirrels is not only are they very interesting, but they're joyful.
Yeah.
You know, the way they bounce, it's lovely.
I don't know if you saw it on social media yesterday, but somebody put up a lovely post on Twitter, and it was one of those squirrel feeding boxes, but with a clear perspex front. And yesterday it was blowing a hooly, and the rain was just bucketing down, and the two squirrels had got inside the box, and the pair
together,
and they are stuffing their faces with peanuts, just looking at the rain running down the outside of the perspex, and it was like two old deers in a bus shelter. It was fabulous. Downside of this is that you moved north to set up a wildlife photography guiding business, and of course, current circumstances.
Yes, it's that has been hugely frustrating. I was supposed to be getting a pod put up in the garden so that I could have wildlife photographers and wildlife lovers come in and stay in, and I was going to build my business around that. You know, and because I've just moved up here, and although I always came up here for holidays, it's a different, doing it as a guide, it's slightly different. So my plans for the last few months would really just to go around and start exploring areas and look to potential locations I could take people. And obviously I haven't been able to do any of that, and the pod has been put back because planning's only just come through now, and I can't even take, you know, it's very hard. People don't even want to commit to anything in the future at the moment because none of us know what's going to happen come the winter, which is the big season up here. You know, I'm a big mountain hare fan, and I was doing quite a lot of mountain hare guiding over the previous winter. But at the moment, you know, I can't get bookings for next winter because everybody doesn't know whether they'll get accommodation, whether they'll be allowed to travel, you know, whether you'll be allowed to be on a hill with someone. From that point of view, it's not been the best timing.
But the potential must be massive, Karen, because I don't know about you, but certainly Mark and I have sensed a really increased interest in wildlife and nature, and it's really made people aware of the surroundings. So the potential of that increased interest in wildlife photography must be massive.
Yeah, I hope so. Ask me in a year from now, I'll tell you. Even friends of mine, you know, who've never really paid that much attention, will get in touch and go, oh, I saw this bird in the garden, what is it? You know, things that they never really paid much attention to before. And it's lovely. I bore people senseless with my love of wildlife. And it's nice that now they're suddenly, they're actually now seeing it and appreciating it for themselves.
Yeah, you don't bore them in the slightest. Karen, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
No, my pleasure. Thank you.
Karen Miller there. And you can find a link to Karen's blog, and she's got some remarkable photographs on our website. Stay tuned if squirrels are your thing. If we've got time, I've got a wee clip of a recording I did with Polly Pooler talking about how she rescued some squirrel kits. Now, our exercise this peak, piece this week... An exercise peak? Well, our exercise peak was probably years ago.
An exercise peak, yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was a Freudian slip. Our exercise piece this week comes courtesy of BBC Scotland's Environment, Energy and Rural Affairs correspondent Kevin Keane. Now, you'll have seen and heard Kevin reporting on everything, electric cars, changing face of the oil industry. But here he is in off-duty mode, which, to be honest, is his default position, on a bike ride accompanied by his daughter, Katie.
Right, you've got your helmet on.
I let out my ponytail because the thing was loose.
Right, where do you want to go?
The one where we went up the hill and on the A96.
Oh yeah, should we do that?
Yeah.
Let's do that then, off you go.
Okay.
I'll cycle behind you. Just be careful at the end. Right, so I live in Inverurie and we're just setting off now from where we live, and we're going to head west onto the A96 very briefly. We're going to take a bit of the old A96 route that runs parallel to it from Mitchell's Dairies, if you know the area. And then about half a mile along there, there's a little cut through a gate, and you're onto the A96 briefly before turning off it again. So you can only really do this just at the minute because there's so little traffic, but it's quite a nice run. Right, so Katie's had her bike for quite some time. Oh, rattly bit of road there. And generally just sort of plays around the front and maybe heads around the block once or twice with it. I've had a bike for a very, very long time, but I just haven't really done much with it for, well, 10 years at least. So a few weeks ago, once we got into lockdown, I decided I was going to revive it a little bit. So I say a little bit, and it turned out to be quite a lot. So I've been in the garage. Car's going past again. I've replaced the chain, I've replaced the front gear cogs, I've replaced the sort of crank handle bit, the back gear cogs, all the gear cables, what else? A few other little bits and pieces, and it sort of works a lot better than it did. Although I haven't quite managed to get the gears to line up quite as much, so when I get into fourth, I might have to get off again and tweak them a bit. But it has allowed us to get out and about a lot more than we perhaps might not have done, which is great. Oh, look, there's a train.
Yeah.
Where's that train going? Whose house will it pass on the way?
Granny's.
Granny's, yeah. Woo! Right, Katie, what have you been thinking about the lockdown? Have you been enjoying it?
It's okay, I guess. It gets a bit boring every now and then.
And we've not really been able to go out on our bikes that much. Why is that? Why is it?
Because your bike keeps needing fixing.
A bit of that, but I was also thinking about Mummy.
And Mummy's pregnant.
Yeah, so she's not really going out. So she's going out for just a short walk every day. But we get to escape, don't we, and go on these slightly longer rides. What do you think of them?
They're good, but they're awful exhausting, and if you don't remember to take water, then you're in trouble.
Oh, I did do that, didn't I? The other day. Oh, change my gear. Oh, there's a car coming. And what happened the other day when we almost got home and we were on that little cycle truck near the house? Can you not remember? Did you not come off? Don't you want to speak about that?
No.
Okay. Fair enough. It was just a little minor accident, wasn't it?
Shut up! You are not recording.
Okay. We're a bit sensitive about that. That's it. Right, we're right at the end of this track, and there's a gate we have to get through, which involves a bit of awkward manoeuvring. I'll go first and open it, and you come behind me. And then that takes us right onto the A96, which is always a bit nerve-wracking for Dad. Right, grab your bike and get ready to cross. Oh, there's two other cyclists. Hiya. Right, remember when we cross, what do we do?
We're crossing right.
Yeah, but straight over to the other side, and then we cycle in that gap on to the left of the white line, so cause there's a car coming. Right, okay, you can go. Right, now we're on the main Aberdeen to Inverness road now, and apart from the car that's just gone past, there isn't a single vehicle, and that's, I mean, completely unheard of, although there's one coming towards me now. I mean, I probably wouldn't cycle with my 9-year-old daughter along this road in normal times. That's it, keep to the left. So, right, so we've just come off the main A96 road onto a minor road that says Harlaw. Look at the hill ahead. Can you see the tractor on the hill?
Whoa,
that's the steep hill we went up and we're about to go up again.
Oh, no, it's a nightmare.
It looks a lot steeper than it felt, isn't it, from where we are now? Look. Anyway, the tractor's up at the top, and if it can make it, we can make it, can't we?
I think this hill is just like the Joe Wicks workout, 30 seconds on and 30 seconds off.
We're going to manage more than 30 seconds, though.
Maybe.
Do you enjoy the Joe Wicks workout?
Yeah. It's exhausting.
Do you enjoy making Daddy sweat?
Yeah.
That's it. Let's get a bit further up the hill.
My teacher did say it was the hottest day of the year so far.
Yeah. Was that when you were on Teams earlier?
Yeah.
What were you doing on there with the teacher?
Oh, we were reading our class novel, Mr. Stink.
Is it good?
Yeah.
Wow.
Look at the view.
What can you see?
Pretty much everything. The cars look tiny from up here.
They do, don't they? Right, we're about halfway up this hill then, so we just need to do the other half, and then it's pretty much downhill from there. Is that the good bit?
Yeah.
You ready? Last push up to the top. Let's see if we can make it in a one this time. Right, last little bit. This is a long downhill. What can you see just in front of us there?
Inverurie.
That's it. And who lives there?
Us.
Us. So is this a final stretch?
Pretty much.
Right, you go first.
Okay.
Environment, Energy and Rural Affairs correspondent for BBC Scotland, Kevin Keane there, and his daughter, Katie, 9 years old and a star in the making, I would contend, Mr. McElroy.
I would absolutely suggest so, but yeah. Just listening to that, it really rams home that we need streets that don't have cars on them.
Yeah.
You know, we need proper cycle paths, and if the one thing to come out of all this is we really need dedicated paths, I see that there's the one in Drem, Gullen
yeah.
is happening, you know, and we need so many more of these all around the country, because, you know, just listening to that, I wouldn't want to cycle on that road. It's just too busy.
No. It's when he said A96, I went, what? Seriously busy road. Normally, I would say it's getting busier again, but this, I would say, and a lot of people have commented on this, it's a chance to actually recapture some of the streets.
Yeah.
You know, if councils are thinking in terms of we need to encourage more walking and cycling and things like that, you're never going to get a better time than this to actually implement it, because people are accustomed to it at the moment. There's two folk just walking up the drive at the moment. Well, not the drive, just past the drive, and they've got shorts on. They must be off. Seriously? Oh, for the love of goodness. It's put me off completely. Time to reveal our mystery bird. Put us out of our misery, please, Mr. McElroy.
Yes, the mystery bird. It's probably Britain's most anticipated bird. For hundreds of decades, people have scanned the skies in spring, waiting for this sound. The arrival of the swallow from Africa for another season in the north makes it official. Summer is coming. And in some parts of Germany, castle guards were allocated special watching rotas in the towers to spot their arrival. The first to see the birds being allocated drink as a reward, and the news was then announced around the town to bring joy to the population. And it does bring joy. About 10 years ago, I recorded an audio diary of the swallow's year. Now, I'm not going to play it all, but here's my little bit of joy one fine spring morning.
Well, it suddenly happened. You almost, there's a sense of expectation. You feel it's going to happen. It's the 28th of April. We're a day late, but suddenly he's arrived. And you just get that call, swirling round the courtyard, single male, checking it out, going into the garage. He's looking for a cave, and my garage is the closest thing I've got. He's checking out the nests, and yeah, it's looking good.
And of course, there's folklore, a lot of folklore, and some of it based in science. When swallows fly low, the rain will come. When swallows fly high, they bring forth the sun. And that's based on the fact that during wet weather, they stay close to the ground where the insects are. When the sun's out, they go way up high, tiny specks in the sky, again following the food. And in Germany, again, now this is a bit of an odd one, but feel free to try. In Westphalia, when a young man sees the first swallow of the year, he stands still and checks underneath his shoe to see if there's a hair under it. And if there was, then the colour of the hair would indicate the colour of the locks of his future love. And in Wallonia in France, a girl, if she sees a swallow skim over the water, she will marry before the age of 19. And this is where it gets really bizarre, in England, a man would put the ring of his intended in a swallow's nest for 9 days. And that would ensure she would accept him. Guaranteed. And all over Europe in spring, folk would open barn doors, stable doors, sheds, as having swallows close to your home is guaranteed good luck. Of course, if they decide not to come back, well, that's not so good. And in the Netherlands, if the swallows leave or the nest falls, they're advised to leave home immediately. Swallows are good things, and some folk put up boards to help them build their nest on, or some like me have a little swallow flap. Here's my happy ending from many years ago, and if you listen carefully, you can hear the beating of the wings as the adults bring insects to the chicks.
It's the 25th of June, and the male and the female have been popping in and out of my little swallow hatch at the top of my garage door. That's there to prevent my tame killer cats from taking my summer visitors. But I'm really getting quite excited now. I'm going to have a wee look. Try not to disturb them. And this is just great. This building's about 150 years old. And there's nests all over the place, and they've renovated it out, and there's three little faces just peeping over the top of the nest, just wondering what's going on. It's a beautiful sight. And all the time, you've got the male and the female just scurrying in and out with little bits of fresh mud. They're getting the mud about a quarter of a mile away. It's incredible business, but they're working away, and it's looking pretty good.
I have to say, swallow flap had me reduced to tears of laughter. What is a swallow flap?
Well, it's a little hole, but well, 10 inches long by 6 inches with a cut a hole in the garage door, and you make a little flap that you can fold up on a hinge and you can lock it for the rest of the year. But when the swallows arrive, you open it, and what's so funny about that? It means you don't have to have the garage door open.
Let me run through, if I can, some of these correct answers. I have to say, the difference between post and you know, pre and post obvious clue that you gave is quite extraordinary. Sue Heard says, good morning, a hard act to swallow. Jean Knowles got it wrong, said chit-chat. Paul Lennard, morning both. A swallow to cheer up the stormy morning. Just love the flying blue nun. Trish says, it's a swallow, Hirondelle. What did happen to that awful wine? I drank it, Trish. Ian says, blue tit or wren. Neither, I'm afraid, Ian. And then post the obvious clue. Swallow, says Lil Forrest. Alex says, yep, mystery bird is a swallow. John and Elgin says swallow. Isabel Sky, swallow. Paddy says swallow. Keith Sutherland says swallow. Stuart Ain Pollock, I suspect, says it's a swallow. I have only seen my first two together perched on a wire on work on Thursday and thought, yep, summer is here and so is the rain. And Barry Sutherland said the week's mystery bird is a swallow and goes on to say, I get ticks off using one drop of vinegar or even condiment and they run like wildfire. I kid you not. I've got them off myself and my dogs. I'm not going to argue with that, Barry. We were hearing about squirrels earlier when we spoke to wildlife photographer Karen Miller, which put me in mind of another squirrel enthusiast, wildlife writer Polly Pooler. Now, I met up with Paul in Ardnamurchan, her childhood home, a couple of years back, and we did an extended interview with her. Part of the conversation turned to her role as basically adoptive squirrel mum.
I was bought 3 little squirrels 7 weeks ago. They came from Athol Palace Garden in Pitlochry, and they were the smallest baby squirrels I'd ever been handed. And I must admit, when they arrived, I thought, no hope.
Mm-hmm. How old were they?
They were about 4 days old by their weight.
They must have been tiny.
They were tiny, and they were sort of naked and clammy. Uh-huh. And Anyway, first week I was really feeding them every 2 or 3 hours, getting up through the night. And then they began to really pick up, and I thought, this is amazing. Nearly lost one of them one night. She got bloated, too much milk, and I thought she was a goner. But amazingly, they've survived, and they're now out in an aviary, which is why I was able to get away this time. Because the last time I came here, a month ago, I had to bring them with me. They were still small enough to transport, because they needed feeding all the time, and nobody else was able to do it. They were quite awkward. They didn't really like somebody else feeding them.
But when you have something that small, and they are extremely tiny, I mean, but it's, you know, smaller than a mouse, and it's hairless, you can feed it, but how do you mimic being a mummy squirrel
difficult? I decided to, you know, you're always trying to learn from the last time you did it, and I'm very fortunate to have some mentors at the SSPCA at Fishcross, and then Romain Pitsey, the vet who does a lot of exotic things at Edinburgh Zoo. When there was a problem, I phoned him and he was really helpful. So I'm very fortunate to have these people who've got a lot of experience. And I suppose when you do any form of rehabilitation, the great thing is to pass on knowledge, to pick up knowledge from other people, because you can always improve it. So to answer your question about how did I mimic the mother squirrel, firstly, I had to keep them very warm. And then I had these little cotton wool pads, not cotton wool balls, because they would stick to them with their... They got quite sharp claws, even when they're newly born. And they would be... After every feed, I would have to wipe them all over with the moist, warm cotton wool. And then I devised a system of brushing them with a little squirrel hair brush. And then that would send them back to sleep. And then, because I imagine the mother, if you see...
Like squirrel massage.
Yes, exactly. You want to keep them very content and warm and relaxed. And I reckon the more you do that, the less likely they are to pick up infections. But, of course, that can all go wrong. Yeah. And they can pick up infections so easily.
So the mother in the dray would be feeding them and then grooming them.
Well, she would be licking them.
Licking them.
I did draw the line of licking them. Yeah, I thought maybe that was beyond me. Yeah.
Much as you love animals.
Yeah, I thought that was probably a wee bit much. But it seemed to work. I hadn't tried that before, but they certainly seemed to like it. There was some little delighted squeaks, which was good. Because they do get very stressed, obviously, without their mother. I think having 3 is a very good thing.
Yes.
You know, because they had each other. If it was just been one, it's much harder.
I've been in your aviary when you had a previous lot of young squirrels, and they basically just treat you like a climbing frame.
Oh, no, they do. I was just like a sort of human climbing frame, and in fact now we're at the commando training stage where they're out in the aviary and we just have to ignore them because we've got to stop that.
They've got to go wild again.
They've got to go wild
again. Do they?
I think they do, yes, quite quickly, especially if there's three of them. I think if we don't handle them at all, which we won't, and we just put the food out, then I think, yes, they do.
One of my best memories from a lifetime broadcasting is actually being used as a tree by these squirrels just running up and down me in Polly's aviary. It's a fantastic experience.
You've got an endless list of lifetime bests.
No, I really enjoyed that. It was always a delight talking to Polly anyway. But, you know, between licking squirrels and swallow flaps, I tell you, you don't get this in the John Beattie show. You just don't.
Well, no, absolutely. But it's a great chance to kind of dig in the archive a bit. You know, not a huge amount, but just there are so many little nuggets of things that we've all done over the years. It's just great to hear it again.
Yeah.
Polly, how can that not bring a smile to your face?
Yeah, well, exactly, exactly. That's all we've got time for this week. Please don't forget to download the Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available from noon today, as well as a special midweek podcast, which this Wednesday is with former TV presenter Philippa Forrester, currently living in the Midwest of America, surrounded by wolves. She's written about the experience. We were talking earlier about the one we did with Chris Watson this last week, award-winning sound recorders. Some fabulous stuff in there, particularly the bearded seals. I have never heard anything like that at all. From all of the team here at BBC Aberdeen, thank you very much for listening to this programme.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.